Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is writer and educator Lamar Herron. Herron is a professor emeritus of creative writing and contemporary literature at Cornell University. He is the author of 7 books, including the novels The Lies Boys Tell and House of the Deaf. He's also the author of a memoir called Romancing Spain. His forthcoming book is a novel entitled Fractures. Fractures takes on the contentious, controversial, and very emotional topic of fracking and how it affects a large extended family in a small town. Fractures will be published in November by St. Martin's Press. And welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, obviously, you know, this issue of fracking has been all over our region for many years. What brought a novelist to this issue?
Well, it's a source of instant drama. But when we were worried, and still are worried, about fracking coming up into our in Tompkins County, I took a trip down into, a day trip, down to Pennsylvania just to see what I could see for myself, not thinking about a novel. And although a novelist is always thinking about a novel, I wasn't thinking about it. I was just trying to get enlightened and ended up going to Montrose, Pennsylvania, in Susquehanna County. It's where Demick is. I mentioned this in an interview, but after talking to a lot of people and looking at a lot of sites and so forth, and just trying to get a sense of what really was going on as opposed to what was scandalously going on.
Yeah, yeah.
I wandered into the Susquehanna County Courthouse, and I noticed that there were all these desks set out in the hall, the long hall in the courthouse, and a policeman was there on duty, and I asked him about it, and he said they'd had to set out all these desks because an enormous amount of people were coming in to check their titles on their land, and that some family members were disputing titles with other family members just to see whose land belonged to whom. And, you know, it didn't take me long to figure out that there was a story in that. I mean, there's a family. I tend to write about families.
Yeah, you always write about families.
Well, I just can't imagine people without families. I mean, you know, if there's a person out there, I want to know who his parents are,
his
brothers and sisters.
Exactly.
At any rate.
Well, the family in this novel is named Joyner, and the patriarch in the family, and the main character, is an architect. Was this based on anybody that you really know?
Or? Well, based on, no. My son's an architect, and I was also very interested in it's a book that's clearly set in a town like Ithaca, if
Absolutely.
Not Ithaca.
Absolutely.
Although it's never named. New York State's never named, for that matter. And certainly there's no university or college. The DeWitt Mall is there.
I recognize it, too. Yeah.
And Bill Downing was a friend of mine who was the architect and owner of the DeWitt Mall. And he told me the story of when they bought the DeWitt Mall, when they saved the old school building from demolition and converted it into what it is. And that's always stayed in the back of my mind.
Oh, so that's why it became part of this novel.
I think. I mean, look, there are a lot of things you can't account for rationally when convergences, they go into novel writing, the larger the novel gets, and these things seem to subliminally in some way to belong together.
Well, I think all writing is like that.
I do, too.
And as a
you
poet,
just, you
I
play,
can,
you play your hunches.
It comes from the subconscious, a lot of it, and your life experience in a lot
That's
of ways.
Right.
Well, tell us a little bit more about the Joyner family. They're obviously dysfunctional, but they've stayed together somehow in some form.
Why are they dysfunctional, obviously?
Well, I mean, when you read the book, you can see that they're dysfunctional. One son is incredibly secretive and strange, and he keeps taking different jobs. The daughter seems promiscuous and not really able to connect to people that well, unless it's sexual, it seems. So, you know,
and the other one's out in California.
Yeah, and the other one's out in California. He's portrayed as the perfect kid, of course.
the stability comes from being that far away from the rest.
And of course,
the
architect has been divorced, and he's contemplating aging and getting older and what it feels like to be an older man. You know, I mean, it's maybe dysfunctional is not the right word, but I would describe it that way in many ways, which means normal.
Well, the reason I say that is because when the older brother, when he comes back from California, I'm not going to give this plot away, actually.
No, no.
But his wife tells him there's a person like your younger brother, the one you're saying who is, I've forgotten which term you used for him, but in every family, she said. And then he goes ahead and speculates about what that means for the remaining family members. I better stop there, but it is a dysfunctional family in some ways, and the daughter mentions that in per se. You more or less described it. I mean, the only little wrinkle in it, which is a huge wrinkle, is that the daughter, who is mid-30s and has a son, She's a single mother who has a son, an 11-year-old son who turns 12 during the course of the book, and he is staying with his grandfather mm-hmm. out on the what amounts to the family farm, which was a family farm, no longer being farmed.
Right, right.
100-plus acres, and which is the drilling ground in question in the book. They really don't know who that boy's father is, or if the mother knows, she's content to remain him, make him fatherless, so that there's not. And that's a bit peculiar. I do admit that. And
so you have no way of telling us why you put that in there, then, huh?
No.
That's interesting.
I don't know where these characters came from. They don't resemble anybody I know.
They seem very real to me. Kudos for making them fleshed out and real to me. None of them seem false. Mm-hmm. And so it reminded me of many of the families I know. Maybe this is the new normal, you know, with strange siblings and people with choices that people wouldn't have made.
Well, you know, writing novels, you do people novels, and you just don't do people novels with people who are utterly alien to you. There's some little part of you that goes into each of these characters or something, you respond to something in yourself and allow that to grow, and that either does or doesn't become a believable character. And I guess these people and members of this family, and there are also some outsiders too that become members of the
mm-hmm,
family.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these people correspond in some way to some facet of myself, I guess.
I would think so.
You don't question this too much. You play your hunches. It feels right. A person's pushing his way on the stage. All right, if he wants to be on stage that much, let him on.
Yeah, I've heard other novelists say that the characters just sort of create themselves and you give them the guidance to flesh themselves out.
Suddenly someone's knocking at your door. You know, there are old plays like this, Pirandello, and anyway.
Let's talk about Frank Joyner, though, the architect patriarch who ends up having to make a decision about whether to give his land over to fracking. It seems ironic to me that he's an architect that restores old buildings, and he could be on the brink of letting this beautiful land that he not necessarily created but kept alive in some ways, he's going to give it over to people who may destroy it. It seems odd to me that...
Well, he doesn't necessarily think it's... I have to say this, he doesn't think it's going to be destroyed necessarily. And I don't believe, at least in any overt way, this novel takes sides on this
fracking
issue.
No, it doesn't.
It may be that this is a way to extract some wealth from that land that can be distributed among all these family members and keep everybody relatively happy and return things to normal. I mean, there's a little refrain that runs through the book that when they've gone, everything's left nice and neat, and it's so very small. And then Frank himself says, you mean about the size of a family cemetery? And he says, about that size. You know, just something small and obtrusive.
But to me, from all the information that I've gathered about fracking, it seems to me that that's a lie, that they can return the land to something that it was before, after drilling all those chemicals. And, you know, I mean, there's got to be some kind of disruption of the land.
That's something you do see. You do see if you go down to, for instance, where I was around Montrose in that area, but other areas down in Pennsylvania, when they've left, it is, to all apparent purposes, very neat and closed in and kind of, you know, innocuous seeming. Now, what's going on underneath the surface, of course, is another story.
And what has happened during the process?
But the main thing about the original question you ask is that, you know, there's something that goes on in this family going back to Frank's grandfather, his great grandfather, and to his grandfather. I mean, there's a sort of suicidal tendency in this family.
Absolutely.
And
I didn't know if you'd want to divulge that.
Well, I'm just going to say no more than that, except that his parents kind of charge him, when they leave the land to him and not to his two sisters, who have both married and left the area, to somehow use the land and distribute its benefits among the family and to keep the peace.
Uh-huh.
It basically is to keep the peace. And he realizes that some pressure is being put on him by the sisters and their spouses to cash in on all the money that's being offered.
Yeah.
And he thinks maybe this is the only way to do it. But
it seems like a deliberate man like an architect would have more information about what could happen. I mean, I've
heard
about polluted water. I mean, but it sounds like he believed the story that he's going to come back after it's all done and it's just going to have a little...
Sure
that's what I got from the novel.
He tells this his ex-brother-in-law at one time in the book. This is another character, this New York lawyer who He's trying to bull his way back into the family.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting character.
Yeah,
actually.
I like him. He came out of nowhere. I have no idea. But at any rate, he tells him, says, look, that coffee you're drinking could kill you. And, you know, we might be wrong about this. And I think he's very skeptical. But he's also halfway convinced by this Texas landman who comes up.
Yeah.
And this guy named Kenny. So I don't know. I mean, that'll be for each reader. I mean,
yeah, it would be for each reader to decide.
Certainly, there's enough talk in the book about devastating consequences of fracking.
Uh-huh.
Whether this family subscribes to that or not is another question.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, it's nice that you didn't get into the fray and just make it one-sided. I mean, somebody's going to get mad at you no matter what.
I don't think you can do that. I mean, if you write a protest novel or a kind of a propagandistic novel, you can't have genuinely complex characters can't exist in a protest novel. I mean, it's a contradiction in terms. They don't blend.
Yeah. Or just a pro novel, not just a protest novel, right? I mean, if you were talking about this is a heavenly idea to frack the earth. That's the other side of a protest novel. That wouldn't have been as quite
either way. But you take a controversial issue like that and come down decidedly on one side of it, you are going to simplify things.
Absolutely.
And maybe even sentimentalize things.
Yeah.
And you have to be very careful. That immediately reduces the character complexity, which reduces the character richness, which makes the characters less interesting.
Yeah. No, I thought you did a great job on that. I kept waiting for something to fly out on one side or another. You did an incredible job walking that, to me, which was a tightrope, considering the issue.
I didn't fall off, but thank you.
Tell us how much research you did about fracking before you did this, though. Did you do extensive?
What I did was, when I realized that this is something I might want to do, then I kept going back down to Pennsylvania and wandering around some of those areas down there, not just Susquehanna County, but... And you know, you can't kind of smuggle your way into these drill sites. They're not going to let you in there. But I certainly observed all I could, and, you know, I smelled and heard and saw what I could see. And I talked to a lot of people in the towns to see what they would tip me off about. And then I discovered something. I'm not very savvy internet-wise, but I discovered that there are a lot of posted videos. Drill workers themselves have posted videos on the drill rig floor of themselves drilling, and you can read about this stuff too. I tried to talk and did talk to some gas companies. They didn't want to talk very long, but a couple of them did talk to me for about a half an hour on the telephone. And I did the reading I could do, and I talked to people up at Cornell, for instance, that knew something about this.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of You can't go into the library and just find huge number of books.
No, but there is a lot
this.
On the internet, and there are a lot of people in science.
That's where you can find it. A lot of interviews on the internet.
Yeah.
And interviews with disgruntled landowners, or with landowners who are quite pleased with the outcome, and they tell stories, and you know, you just pick these things up.
Yeah. Did you talk about anybody who's into the science? Talking about the science, people like Sandra Steingraber. I've had her on the show several times.
I've listened to a lot of those people, and I attend a lot of meetings at Cornell.
Oh, did you?
And Dandy, okay. And people come through and talk about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't want to get into that. I mean, I wasn't fully equipped to get into it. I could have gotten better equipped, mainly because I was just interested in the human drama.
So you were using this issue, the family was wrapped around this issue.
I'm actually,
and it could have probably been any issue.
I say this as a metaphor, you know. And there's this whole thing about drilling down and drilling out.
Yeah.
And then this down and out, plumb your depths and swing wide. That's kind of a refrain in the book. And compulsory integration and all these are interesting metaphors for families or for human subjectivity and all the underground explosions. I mean, as poetic metaphors, they are very powerful and evocative.
Yeah, I could sense that in the novel too, that you're using poetic license in some ways. If you're just joining us, my guest is Lamar Heron. We're talking about his book that's due out next month called Fractures. Now, how much of leasing land did you find was rationalized as a way to help with energy independence instead of, you know, a lot of people think it's just greed is why people are doing this. Did you hear both arguments?
Yeah. Well, I heard that.
Yeah.
If you were to ask me where I thought, I think it comes down more on the side of greed. as opposed to I'm just being a patriot. I'm leasing my land so that we have energy independence. I certainly heard some of that.
Oh yeah,
hearing people talking, going to meetings and so forth. And I suppose that's real. I mean, I remember this woman came. What was her name? Came up from Pennsylvania, from the county over Bradford County. And she was talking about one of the original. She'd been hammered. She was surrounded by people who'd leased their land, and her family went back till the 18th century in that area, she said. But she said there was one family who went back further than theirs did, and these people had indeed leased their land, and for a huge sum of money. I forgot. Mm-hmm. Apparently they were sitting on the rich area right there. And they just took all that money and went off and built a castle overlooking the Atlantic, in Maine, overlooking the Atlantic Ocean.
So they left the land and didn't want to caretake it anymore?
But this doesn't sound like they were hoping to participate in energy independence.
Oh, I see
what
you're
saying. Like they were cashing in and fulfilling some kind of a fabulous dream about a castle overlooking.
Well, see, that's a lot of people's concern, too. People are going to take the money and run and just leave the environmental devastation there for the neighbors to deal with and the towns. Yeah.
Well, you're getting kind of where I stand.
Yeah.
Personally, not as a novelist, but just as a concerned citizen.
Yeah, yeah.
That's another question.
I think that's where a lot of us stand on that. Your gorgeous descriptions of the landscapes, I absolutely loved. It just showed how much you love this area. And it had almost contrasted what I, in my head, thought was going to happen to this beautiful area when this patriarch said yes to the drilling.
Well, you know, I've lived in Ithaca since 1977 when I started teaching at Cornell, and I've never written anything said here, and I just didn't quite understand why. I've either the American Midwest, the American South, or Spain.
Or Spain, yeah.
One of these three locations, and I just told myself I've got to sit down and write a novel of something set in this area, because I like this area, I love it, this is my home.
Yeah,
I'm from here,
and you beautiful poetic descriptions of the area. I mean, any of us who've lived here know what you're talking about. You're talking about this area, even though you don't, specifically say that.
It's a gorgeous place. I mean, my wife, Mediterranean Spanish woman, and there's no way in the world I could pry her away from this area. I mean, she loves this area.
Yeah,
and we have good friends here, and it's a sane, enlightened place and a lovely place, but the lay of the land is very important.
It is.
And the water, and it's
the beauty.
It's hard to, and friends come visit us from Spain, for instance, and they immediately say, "Now I understand why you're not coming back to Spain."
Yeah. Well, that's why I worry too about what could happen if this what I consider kind of a monster comes into our community.
Well, I do.
Because I moved here for the quiet and the peace, and I have 3/4 of an acre up on West Hill, and the thought of big, huge trucks rambling in here and destroying our water supply.
Well, I mean, if you go down there and put yourself where those trucks were rambling, you'd be even more worried. I mean,
I'm sure.
Listen, I don't really look. This is maybe wishful thinking, but I just can't see the hydrofracking being allowed, being gas drilling in any extensive way being allowed in these Finger Lakes counties.
Don't you think it's because there has been a protest and there have been people
protest,
doing their homework?
I mean, Dryden, which was a kind of flag bearer, for our area, has done one. In the Cooperstown, over in Cooperstown too, somewhere right down Cooperstown, and I mean, just hoping this holds up and.
Yeah. I think it's great that you wrote this novel about it because it is going to cause people to talk. I did wonder.
There's the argument, and then June brings it up. The daughter brings it up. You and I are sitting here on the first day of winter, practically. It's still October, but it's awfully cold out there.
It is.
And I'll bet this place we're sitting in is heated by natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody's got to have that gas well in their backyard. There's a scene in Texas where a woman's so outraged because they're literally drilling a gas well in what she thought was going to be her backyard. I know.
We've got to
deal with this.
We haven't had an incredible good conversation about energy issues in this country, really. There have been patches and bits and pieces and arguments on from the different sides. Are you worried that this book, when you go to readings, is going to bring out the political activists?
Well, I don't want to be disingenuous about it. I mean, when I took on the topic, I realized that people were going to just seize on the topic and forget about the characters and the drama, the human drama around it.
Well, I don't think they will because you've you know, created this so beautifully. Mm-hmm. If they read the book, they'll see it. But I'm talking about when you're out there live talking to people and giving readings.
I would expect that, yeah.
It's going to turn into a political issue.
But I'll try to diffuse it in advance by saying things like I've said here. So you just can't. Anyway, I mean, I like literature. I don't
You can say, yeah, I mean, it's obviously a novel. I wanted to ask you this, too. You know, when the film Gravity came out just a few weeks ago, mm-hmm. everybody started talking about, is there any logic to what happens in this? And so then there's an argument about should fiction be real and logical and true? And what do you feel about fiction? Should it be close to truth? Should it be at least logical in regard to issues that are really going on in front of us?
Well, we have to find that word logical. I mean, I think it should be true. And I think it should be not just close to truth. I think it should be truth. But there's, you know, truth has a deep depth.
Yeah,
It's
in many interpretations.
Far beyond just logic. But, I mean, I don't like fantasy. I don't like to read fantasy.
I don't either.
I have a nephew who's, you know, they're maybe 50, the market for fantasy out there is larger than the market for literary fiction. Just better believe
I
that.
I know there is.
Poetry.
Uh-huh.
But I just don't think, I like to have some kind of tether to the world as we know it. Now, you tighten that tether, you tense it. The imagination wants to transform.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of what the imagination is. And it's in that tension between the imagination trying to break free from the accountable world, but being unable to break free, still being faithful to it. I think that's the motive force for good fiction or good art. I mean, it's that tension. But you can't break that tether. I don't want to see that tether. But I don't want people float free in a fantasy realm that's unaccountable.
Yeah.
So there's a tether.
Yeah, I have a hard time with fantasy too. It's never been a genre that I've really cared that much about.
But you know, it's interesting.
Science fiction is kind of interesting.
Well, it is
interesting.
A little that I've read of it, but there's a lot of, you know, this whole thing about what's down there. I mean, there's a to kind of get caught up in the imagining about this fracking and this drilling and. You know, and the vertical and the horizontal going out under other people's property, and it's in you. There's a compulsory integration going on, and whether you think you're alone or no, you're now caught up into this group. I mean, there's something interesting in that.
I start thinking about science fiction. You know, what's in the middle of the earth? You know, some of those old Jules Verne novels.
Mm-hmm.
When you could dig. Remember when we were kids? If you could dig deep enough, you could get to China.
I think I'm not sure the geologists actually know what's down there.
I don't think people do either. No, that's why
I'm
a lot
sure
of people think
they say it's
opening
is there a molten
Pandora's
center
box.
Or is there a cold stone center? I mean,
yeah,
what?
And is there granite? Is there is there all kinds of there might be another planet under there for all we know. But what kind of advice do you give people who are embarking on becoming novelists?
Oof, I did that almost 30 years at Cornell. Read. I mean, have you heard every novelist I've heard ask that question usually answers with that's his first thing he says. Just get start. I mean, there's obviously you've got some itch, something you put your imagination to work, but it's reading that's going to fire you up. And I also say don't worry about falling under the influence stylistically and conceptually of given writers. I mean, one writer in one sense will hand you on to a next. As you become caught up in that person's work, I don't think that's bad. You eventually, using all these other writers, reach your own voice, and it'll be connected to the work that's inspired you, but it won't be imitative. It'll simply have a solid base behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, there's a lot of you have to de-romanticize this. I mean, it's mulishness for novel writing. You sit there for 5 hours, and four of those hours nothing might happen, and then that fifth hour it might all click. So, there's a lot of I always envy my poet friends who can wait for inspiration to light on their shoulders, and then I'm saying that. But really, there is a thing where you've got to
grueling.
four or 5 hours a day if you don't do that. I mean, and especially in the beginning, I think you just can't do it fitfully.
Yeah. Did this novel start out in a fashion that you followed, or did it change while you were writing it? Were there any surprises?
Well, there were surprises. There were surprises, including the climax, which I'm not going to say. But
don't.
No, but this, I like to kind of see the end of books before I begin them, and at least to know where the destination for the book is. I'm not sure I ever saw the destination for this book. I think maybe I did because of the way it starts, but I certainly not in concrete terms. I didn't. I didn't know who was going to participate in the climax of the book, and I don't want to say any more of that, except that this is, I was kind of, you know, just kind of trusting to my intuition on a lot of stuff, and characters were coming in that it's, I'll tell you one quick thing, I don't know how much time we have left, the character of Kenny, this landman from Texas and Arkansas who comes up here, just sprang into my head, and about midway into the novel, I knew I needed something. I took a walk. I was in Spain with my wife's town in Spain. And I took a long walk down this valley, and I don't know where it came from, but it was during that walk that this character just sprang into being. And I said, wait a minute. And I remember sitting on these rocks. It was hot, and taking down, writing as fast as I could in my little notebook. And I look back now and think that character is the one that gave the novel the point in which he comes in, which is about 100 pages in, the lift that it needed. Uh-huh. And I have no idea where that character came from, except he came out of the South.
I thought it was an interesting character because I've never even thought about what a gas man or, you know, when one of these guys from these fracking trucks would be like. You made him into
a
human.
Well, they have this horrible reputation.
Yeah, they do, of coming and taking over towns.
Determined to make one who was not some kind of a monstrous character.
Yeah.
I mean, who was peeling in some ways, or at least wasn't a villain. And,
yeah.
But it was just curious to me how he came. And I realized that I went home and told my wife, I said, well, if this book gets done, it'll be because there's some impetus that came into it today from this character. And I have no idea where he came from.
Yeah, well, no, that was a valuable character for me to see, too. It surprised me when you introduced him, and especially when you let us see his real life and his inner life. And that's what surprised me. I thought he was just going to be a stepping stone.
That's how I've gone back before. Everybody's got a family, so if you can't pull him out of, you can't just pluck him out of nowhere. You've got to give him some kind of grounding.
And we do only have a couple minutes left. Are you working on anything now?
There's something in my mind that I really want, but I'm kind of caught up in the promotion of this and talking to people about this right now. But I do want to get started on something. I have something in mind, but I'm not actually putting pen to paper or fingers on to keys.
Okay, so it's just simmering. It hasn't even started.
Well, it's close. I need to get away. I find that I tend to begin works when I'm over in Spain.
Oh,
that's where I began
that.
Fractures. Uh-huh. And maybe I need to get back over there and begin this book. I don't know.
Uh-huh. And can you tell us where you're going to be reading next?
The 9th of November at 4 o'clock is the inaugural reading for the book at Buffalo Street Books. 4 o'clock, that's a Saturday, the 9th of November. And then there's something on the 14th in Vestal and the 15th. I hope I'm getting this right.
I know you're doing something at Barnes & Noble, aren't you?
Yeah, that's on the 14th in Barnes & Noble and Vestal at 7 o'clock. And then it's 6:30 on the 15th of November, which is a Friday, at River Reed Bookstore in Binghamton.
Oh, great. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Lamar Heron. We have run out of time. Again, the book is called Fractures. I do recommend that you go out and get it. It's very interesting, and it has a lot to do with what's happening in our culture at this very moment. Lamar Heron, thank you.
Well, it's been a pleasure again.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.